Welcome to UN Gender Focus. I'm Deanne Penn at the United Nations in New York. Coming up in this week's program, a new interactive map shows how anti-gay laws in some countries are a legacy of British colonialism. And South Sudan's women want a peaceful future for themselves and their children. But first, women serving in UN missions around the world are often just the better communicators when it comes to community policing. That's the view of Stefan Fella, the police advisor in the UN's Department of Peacekeeping Operations, DPKO. He said that for years and years, the UN has been asking member states to contribute more women to police service, but it's been an uphill struggle. Claire Montant asked him to outline what was expected of UN police, regardless of their sex or nationality.
Basically, police officers do two things. We contribute to protecting civilians in conflicts or in post-conflict situations where population has been painfully witnessing and been subjected to conflicts. And we do capacity building in order to restore the capacity of police.
Only 10% of UN police officers are women. Why is that, and what are the challenges for women to serve in the peacekeeping operations?
We have for years and years and years been calling on member states to send us more female police officers. We take every female police officer that member states give us, but the limit is not because we do not want to have more, but member states have difficulties to give us more, which has to do with the role of police officers in police organizations all over the world, where you have a strong commitment to female police officers, you will see that that member state is able to give us more. So we work on promoting women's rights, gender mainstreaming, and female policing, and hope that member states will implement that into national policies.
And what do you think that women can bring that men cannot bring to these peacekeeping operations?
It's the same thing. There are things that women can bring to the table, and there are things that men can bring to the table, and there are things that both bring to the table. And men and women are equal. It doesn't really matter in one sense, and in another sense it matters a lot. Because female police officers are able to talk to parts of the population in many of these societies where their male colleagues are unable to reach those. So in these situations already, our female police officers are just simply invaluable because nobody would be able to protect women and children in such a society. But on the other side, when it comes to community policing, you will see that men and women have a different attitude to solve conflicts. And sometimes women are just the better communicators. And you will see that conflict resolution together with women and men is better than by men alone.
A new interactive historical map on the criminalization of homosexuality across the world shows how British colonialists exported anti-gay laws during the 19th century. That's according to the UN Human Rights Office, OHCHR. The map allows users to see how laws have changed since the 1790s up until today. Homosexuality continues to be outlawed in 76 countries in Africa, as well as in the Middle East and Asia. Janie Cangelosi has been speaking to OHCHR's Charles Radcliffe.
So this is a map that basically brings together all the data we could gather about when countries criminalized same-sex relationships and when they decriminalized them. And, you know, there's a huge amount of information in there, but the nice thing about this map is it's very simple. It has a little slide at the bottom, and you can literally scroll through the years and watch as this kind of wave of red washed over the world in the 18th and 19th centuries as countries criminalized homosexuality. And then that wave starts to recede in the 20th century as more and more countries decriminalize.
And what kind of trends do you think this demonstrates?
It tells, I think, an interesting story, several stories really. One is that there is clearly a link between the spread of European empires in the 19th century, between colonialism, in other words, and the criminalization of homosexuality. When the 19th century started, we found 50 countries that criminalized same-sex relationships. By the time that century ended, that number had more than doubled. And the big event of the 19th century was, of course, the expansion of the British Empire, and the British exported anti-gay laws to many of their colonies during the 19th century.
What do you hope people gain from this map? What kind of awareness do you hope to raise with it?
Well, I hope it helps to set some of our current debates in a historical perspective. You know, it's not true that that there was ever a kind of history of criminalizing gay people in Africa, in Asia, in Latin America, in fact, before the European empire builders got there. So these laws were really imposed on countries from London, from Madrid, from Lisbon. And it's taken years of anti-colonial struggle to rid countries of these laws, and it's still an ongoing process. One of the interesting things I think we see with the map is the kind of high point for the number of countries that criminalized homosexuality was reached in the 1950s and 60s. So there's a bit of a lag. You know, decolonization was already underway, but it took countries time to begin to strip away these oppressive laws. And many still haven't done so yet. It's an ongoing process, driven by many other factors too, of course, whether, you know, the emergence of student activism and a civil rights movement and higher levels of education, all of these things have an impact on the speed at which change can take place.
Women in South Sudan are clear that they want a peaceful future for themselves and their children, according to a senior UN official who recently visited the country. Maria Noel Vaeza, director of the program division at UN Women, the UN's gender entity, said she is hopeful that South Sudan's women will contribute to and support peace efforts there. South Sudan became independent in July 2011, but has been engulfed in more than 2 years of political turmoil, which has killed thousands and forced more than 2 million people from their homes. Sebit William asked Ms. Vaeza for her impressions of women's progress in the world's newest nation.
I'm very much impressed by the leaders, the women leaders of South Sudan in the civil society, in the parliament. I've been with them in a dinner on the first day I arrived. And also in government, I met the Ministry of Gender, the Ministry of Information Technology. I'm very much impressed by their commitment, by their resilience, by their strategic thinking, and by their efforts towards a peace solution and a peace agreement.
Now, how does the United Nations Women address the obstacles to women's programs, especially the ordinary woman who is right there in the village struggling with living?
Well, we are working programs that relate to livelihood, to attend the humanitarian crisis, internal displaced camps, and to provide these women instruments that can help them in their sustainability. For example, we provide vocational training so they can acquire different skills that can help them to come out of the humanitarian support towards a sustainability and economic sustainability. And with that self-sustainability comes their dignity and comes their strength to be leaders politically, and also to continue enhancing their economic empowerment.
What have you seen as the biggest challenge that is facing the women in South Sudan?
Well, the biggest challenge is that we need to have an end to the conflict and to have a peaceful solution in the coming days towards a government that is of reconciliation. But we are very hopeful that a very sustainable solution will come up from all parties. And we hope that the women can continue to have their footprint and their leadership. And this is what gives me hope, that there's a lot of very strong South Sudanese women involved in the peace process, supporting the peace process. So I'm very, very hopeful for what I saw. And the women are very clear what they want. They want peace. They want to continue receiving support to strengthen their economic power, to have self-sustainability, to make sure that they build a future for their children, and of course education. That is something that all women are striving for, because they want to get their children prepared for the future.
You've been listening to UN Gender Focus from the United Nations in New York. You can follow more of our programs at radio.un.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening. I'm Deanne Penn.